Good morning. You're listening to Labor Beat Radio on www.enlightenradio.org. And we broadcast weekly, 10 a.m. on Tuesdays, Eastern Time. Good morning and welcome. You know, just a little bit of intro on, we have on our speakers, or actually the recording of three speakers this morning. One is Fefe Lee, that's her actual name. She's in charge of Stanford's Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence Institute. And and she has a conversation with two people. One, an Oxford professor of computer science who was also a VP at McKinsey, which is probably the biggest management consulting firm in the world, maybe. It's very close to it. And especially on issues of staffing and workforce issues, quote unquote. And also Mary Kay Henry, who is the president of the Service Employees International Union. And the discussion is focused on the impact on jobs that artificial intelligence technologies are going to have, both in terms of new jobs, jobs that are probably wiped out, and jobs that are changed. I think about the first 9 minutes of it will be an introduction to the key themes involved there.
Just stimulate a conversation.
Yeah. So we're talking about, and these are all people that are, top experts in the discussion, and so we're not going to be out in the cornfield talking about stuff that's irrelevant to the main debate. We can get started with that. Welcome to the Labor Beat Radio program here on Enlightened Radio. My name is John Case, and my two good friends and co-hosts here on this program, J.B. Christensen and Scott Marshall. And we're going to talk today on a theme that Scott said we should talk about last week, and that would be artificial intelligence and its impact on labor in particular and on jobs. And so, as I was just saying, and we did some research and decided to, go all the way to the top of the tree on this one and consult. And I found a great introduction to this whole question from Stanford University. And I'm going to play a clip from it. It includes a leadership of Stanford on the whole challenge of artificial intelligence, and especially its impact on humans, as well as vice president of the Kinsey company that is a major management consulting company on major corporations across the world, and Mary Kay Henry, president of the Service Employees International Union, representing many service workers in the United States. Let's start with this discussion, and then we'll get into it afterwards. So I'm going to share the screen for my colleagues here, although on the radio you'll only be hearing the audio portion of it. Let me help them so they can actually see it as well. If I can just get my, let's see, John. Share screen. And there we go.
Are you recording?
Yes.
Okay.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Director's Conversation by the Stanford Institute of Human-Centered AI, or HAI. My name is Fei-Fei Li. I'm a professor of computer science and the Denning co-director of HAI at Stanford University. I'm just so thrilled and honored that joining me today are two very distinguished guests and friends of Stanford High. Mary Kay Henry is the international president of the Service Employees International Union. She leads nearly 2 million American workers, from janitors to healthcare workers to teachers. And just recently, she was named one of the Times' most influential people of 2020. Also joining me today is my dear friend, James Manica. James holds a PhD in AI from Oxford University and now is a senior partner at McKinsey & Company and the chairman of the McKinsey Global Institute. Under his leadership, the McKinsey Global Institute produces cutting-edge research on technology and digitization, the future of work, productivity and competitiveness, and globalization. Thank you so much, James and Mary Kay, for joining me today. What an honor. Let me just start off our conversation with one question, and hopefully this will be a very dynamic and organic dialogue among three of us. You know, we talk about, today we're going to focus on talking about AI and the future of work. And to be perfectly honest, when these two terms are put together, there's often a lot of fear, right? The word replace comes to the mind of many, including the public, the media, and the image of robots replacing us, replacing workers tend to be prominent as well. As a technologist myself, I tend to be working on technology that's actually on the flip side, that is more complementing people and assisting people, especially my own work in healthcare, where AI in the forms of smart sensors and algorithms are trying to give doctors and clinicians and nurses an extra hand or extra pair of eyes to help make patient care better. But I want to just ask both of you, when it comes to AI and this suite of technology related to data, machine learning, decision making, who do you think are the most impacted? And what are the opportunities and challenges we see about AI and work from their vantage points? Maybe we'll start with Mary Kay and then James.
Thanks, Fei-Fei. All of the service and care workers that I represent and I'm in relationship with, their key issue is how are they involved in the introduction of artificial intelligence or any kind of technology in their work, because they think they have a lot of ideas about how to use it to both complement their work or if it's going to replace the work they do. They'd love to understand how government, business, and working people can join together to unleash their work into something else. So for me, the answer to your question is that the service and care workers in the U.S. economy have many things impacting them at this moment, the global health pandemic, the deepening economic crisis. But really, it's built on a structural foundation in the economy and democracy that has undervalued this work since the beginning of time. And we know that 70% of the U.S. workforce is in the service sector, and one in four jobs are care jobs. And those jobs are poverty jobs that in most cases, there's 2 million Black, brown, and immigrant women doing home care work in this nation. It's the fastest growing job. I think those workers would love to understand how technology and artificial intelligence could actually elevate the work they do, caring for the nation's elderly and people with disabilities. But right now, they have no access. There are structural barriers to their work. There's a lack of regular schedule. They have to hustle for hours every week, and one week to the next, they don't know really what their schedule is. which makes it impossible for them to engage in any kind of ongoing education. And then the other thing that is an impact is they're excluded from the ability to join together and form a union and bargain a better life. That also keeps them from being able to have a dialogue with their employers about how artificial intelligence and technology gets introduced into their work. So for me, the biggest impact is on the parts of the economy that have been excluded for a very long time and have been underpaid. And that's what I hope our conversation today will focus on, which is how do we unleash the 44% of the US workforce that's paid $18,000 a year. And those workers are living below the poverty line, but in a lot of cases are working 80 to 100 hours a week. And they would love to figure out how technology could enhance their work.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, James?
Yeah, no, thank you for the question, Feifei. I think it's, you know, there's obviously a lot of concern about technology and its impact on jobs and work. And I think, you know, that some of the research that we've done and others have done too, similar research, if you look at jobs, each occupation, whether it's what a welder does, what a teacher does, what a doctor does, is made up of constituent activities. Where, you know, no one job is fully one thing. So if you look at the constituent activities, so we've looked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics looks at over 800 occupation categories in the United States. And we've looked at all the constituent activities that people do. And we've tried to understand the impact of AI and its related technologies on each of those activities. The pattern, when you look at that and you factor in the economics, the pattern that emerges is the following. There will be jobs that will grow, actually, and other ones that will be created. So that's a good thing. Think of that as jobs gained. There will be jobs that will be lost, partly because, technology will be able to do the various activities involved in that job. And the third, there will be jobs that will be changed. And the jobs change is part of the fact that while the job is still there, technology will complement some of those activities. So if you put all those three pieces together, which is the jobs gained, jobs lost, and jobs changed, the net of the jobs lost and jobs gained is actually positive. So there's actually more work. In fact, the share of jobs and occupations that can be fully automated in terms of all their constituent activities is actually relatively small, at least for the next several decades. The bigger issue is, in fact, the jobs changed question. This is where technology that complements what workers do, what people do, becomes critically important. And I think Mary Kay is correct that, you know, if in fact workers can be part of that process as we think through the jobs changed, that will actually lead to very, very good outcomes for workers. And as I said, the jobs change is the biggest part. Mm-hmm. So it is what I always tell people when we have this conversation is, don't worry about a jobless future. It is not for many, many decades. What we should think about is how we manage the transitions and adaptations as we help workers cope with this. Let me come back and start to close in, I think, a little bit on what Mary Kay was describing. So if I'm saying don't worry about a jobless future, there are some things that we have to solve. Let me describe at least four of them. The first one is we do have to solve the skills question, because as jobs change, we're going to need to make sure that workers can actually adapt, learn skills to be able to work alongside machines, or move into occupations that are actually growing. So the skills question is, in fact, a real thing for us to work on. The second question is, how do we help workers transition from declining occupations to the occupations that are growing? And this is where policy and other mechanisms are really, really important to make sure we support the workers, we have the safety nets and the benefit models and transition supports to actually help workers transition. That's the second thing. The third thing that I'd highlight is, in fact, what Mary Kay raised, which is the wage question. Because one of the challenges that we've got here is that some of the hardest occupations to automate and the ones that are going to grow tend to be in sectors like care work, as Mary Kay described. We need real people to do that work. They tend to be teachers. They tend to be all these occupations that are really, really important and fundamentally human. The challenge with our labor market systems is that those tend not to be some of the best paid jobs in the economy. So even if there is work, we have to think about how do we support living wages and be, you know, for people doing that work to be able to live. So the wage question is actually a fundamentally important one. The fourth and final thing that we need to solve for is how do we actually redesign work? Because what happens is, you know, the workplace actually changes as we bring in technology into the workforce. In fact, it's one of the things that Mary Kay and I and others and we've been talking about, which is how do we think about data in the workplace? How do we think about redesigning the work itself? And by the way, if we didn't think these questions about redesigning work were urgent, we only have to pay attention to what's happening with COVID right now.
Exactly. Where
some of the workers who actually have to show up for work are exposed physically, and we're now having to think about how do we redesign their workplace.
All right. In fact, I'll pause it there. Enough, quite a bit of food for thought that conversation. And probably the key issues for most workers were touched on by both Mary Kay Henry and the I can't remember his name right now, the fellow from McKinsey. And and that is that if the workers are not involved directly in, negotiating with their employers in conversations about how the technology is going to be implemented, and if there are not enough social, meaning, political, basically, support for people in transition from one occupation to another, or from one gig to another, or in something called the last resort, who is the employer of last resort in a full employment economy, which is pretty much the only kind of economy that makes sense. You know, in terms of what you're trying to do right here with making sure nobody gets left behind. That's kind of the key message that I sort of took from it. Somehow that principle needs to be enshrined in national industrial policy. It's not the thing. Oh, whoa, gee, look, we used to have a middle so-called middle class, and now we have a so-called rust belt. How did that happen? Right? How did that happen? You know, we didn't plan ahead at all. You know, the whole bunch of people got left behind, and can't say that that's been good for the country. You know. What do you guys think?
Well, just a quick little subnote or whatever you want to call it. The threat of AI is kind of invading everybody's thought process in a lot of ways because they keep saying it and bringing it up. And so I had a nightmare where I thought AI had taken over and was ruling the world, and there was nothing you could do about it. You just weren't going to be able to do anything anymore. Fortunately, I woke up. But
right. Wasn't that the premise of the Terminator?
I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. But it's become very real to some people these days, you know?
Sure.
I mean, anyway, You know, one of the things that I think a lot more attention needs to be paid to is how AI is changing production and changing the way things are made and all of that. And it raises, like, just an example is that because of how I've mentioned it before on this show, I think it's Japan, there's a factory that can build a car from start to finish without ever being touched by human hands. And it rolls off the assembly line ready to drive. And, you know, I mean, that was a hell of a lot of jobs involved in making that car. But one of the things that's happened because of this change in production is that, you know, one of the most sought after apprenticeships these days is robot care, because the robots have to be taken care of and they have to be repaired and they have to be programmed and all of those kinds of things. And so that's, you know, that's just an indicator of how much production is changing. And all of that raises the issue that they raised very well in this conversation about how, what happens to the workers when that happens. And, you know, even some short-term things are beginning to come to the fore and get demanded. I mean, I can't remember what, but anyway, some people are demanding a shorter work week with no cut in pay kind of thing, which, you know, we went through that before, but now it's just a much more poignant point that to keep workers with a decent standard of living and to keep the corporations from just squeezing workers out completely, we need things like a shorter work week and with no cut in pay kind of thing. Anyway, there's a lot more things we need, but anyway, that was my initial thoughts.
You know, there's a perfect example of it taking place right here in Jefferson County, U.S. Virginia, where one of the major employers that located here, it was either at the end of Senator Byrd's tenure or at the beginning of Manchin's, I can't remember, as governor. But anyway, the American Military University was one of the early online university efforts, pretty much a completely contracted out of the U.S. military for servicemen and women abroad to get degrees or get certifications and subjects while they were deployed. And then later it expanded out and they developed a commercial version, which got itself somehow certified as an actual university. Most of the online programs are not that way. Or at least a big sector of them. Anyway, that model of associating yourself with an actual public university institution as a means of, and duplicating it sort of as is online, that model has failed with AI. And AI's main value add there is that you can virtualize the top educational opportunities in the country. You know, like for example, one of the ones we were just looking at is a perfect example, Stanford's, and then embody it in a commercial offerings, right through Coursera and a number of other platforms. And the demand for those skills that are being taught is so high. And they can be instructed, by the way, multilingual on these platforms. So many different countries can participate. And you end up with people just bypassing regular university programs. And what happened in our local center, American Public University, they basically, the whole thing is evaporating and turned into contracted out to basically private online educational enterprises that have no association directly with, you know, a particular public university, because they're just, they're not constrained by all kinds of faculty restrictions and stuff like this. Right now, the courses are owned by the private entity, not by any public entity, and they can be copyrighted and sold, but there's no union organization of any the teachers or anything like that, or any instruction things. It's all done by contract. And so, you know, you I'm sure you give up almost all rights you might have to a course that you taught, but you taught it for so-and-so company, and they own it now. So, you know. Anyway, yeah, so it's having an immediate impact right here. That was the highest-paying hourly jobs in the county. Okay. I mean, there's a manufacturing facility that moved in. It's close to it. But you know, so the one that was there, I mean, that was not basically technical people. Okay. Gone.
I thought it was interesting, John and Scott. I thought it was interesting in the interview that they quantified the jobs lost and the jobs gained. And what was the third category?
Jobs changed.
Jobs changed. And, you know, redefining. I would go further and say redefining jobs and education, of course, education too, because, you know, you'd have to train them up. But I thought that was very interesting. It was the first time I'd heard that there would be a positive impact as far as jobs lost and jobs gained.
If you count the hopeful ones that are changed, but that's the big issue, right? I mean, who's going to provide the education to workers who can't even predict their schedule next week, right? You know, like the home health care workers that that Mary Kay Henry was talking about, right? I mean, how are you going to, you know, if you don't have some change in the workers' control over their work lives, a little at the collective bargaining level, you know, how are they going to have time, you know, to go out?
Well, we're looking at it, John. We're looking at the picket line right now for GM.
Well, there you go. Well, right.
And that's a big issue. That's a huge issue in this fight, in this strike, was, you know, how are we going to convert engine manufacturing jobs of the internal combustion engine to battery jobs,
right?
And who's going to control that? And, you know, just the whole thought of it is how we can retrain these workers from what they have done, you know, for forever, you know, decades upon decades, into something that's fairly new, you know, within the last 20 years of manufacturing these batteries that you know, they're changing the way energy is provided nowadays. I mean, our company sells batteries every day. We sell the Powerwall every day. And it's just amazing to see how people can fork over 10 grand, you know, to have a backup battery system in their house. I don't know. It boggles the mind, but there's a lot of people out there that can afford it. But there's so many more people, you know, the vast majority can only dream about it. You know, they'll never have that kind of cash where they can just, you know, buy a battery to back up in case of a power outage. I mean, usually we just light a candle and you know, pray for the lights to come back on. So it is changing slowly, and I think we'll adapt, you know, like we always have. We're going to adapt in the end, but you do have to plan for it. And you do have to plan for wages and, you know, the new jobs that are created, the defining of new jobs and how you're going to be compensated for that. I mean, there's a whole lot to talk about because we have no idea what the impact's going to be. I mean, there's some people that do. Obviously, the people we just saw on the recording, they have a better idea than anybody that we've talked to. But until it really happens, until the curtain is opened, you see behind the curtain, you know, we have to trust that we will survive. We will transition like we always have. And, you know, human nature will take care of it.
You know, another big aspect of this that we haven't spent enough time on, I think, is how to constrain the corporations, because obviously they're going to take every step they can to use this to lower wages and working conditions and all of that kind of stuff. Are there legal holds? You know, I mean, the whole NLRB was created because of the way corporations were trying to break unions and stuff. And I think we have to think about what are the kinds of laws that we need to keep the corporations from, you know, just totally wiping out workers' rights and those kinds of things, because they're going to do it. They're going to do everything they can to increase their profits, and to hell with the rest of us. And so, I mean, I don't have any specific ideas yet, but I think we got to start focusing on that. And we've got to start thinking about what kind of constraints can be put on the heart of capitalism to keep them from just destroying so many people.
Well, you have to disenfranchise them from running the political system. I mean, as long as they're running the political system, I mean, they're going to get their way. Okay, so you know, 8 times out of 10. And the problem is that you know, the political system run by billionaires is starting to demonstrate considerable dysfunction. And not just not unfair or inappropriate or not just, but also just, you know, almost, you know, difficult to sustain, to solve any problem without just internal collisions taking place all the time. And so I think, you know, you could maybe straightforward. I mean, for giant corporations where they're too big to fail in many cases, you have to talk about more socialism. There mm-hmm. is no other solution besides, you know, the public taking more control over these private entities. I mean, at least, you know, as Vladimir said one time, the commanding heights, at least. And, right. I mean, so if the state doesn't, and you have the perfect example, I can't, in the battle over intellectual property right now, where these giant corporations have more data about, you know, Americans, not just Americans, by the way, than their governments do. And they have more influence, and they're able to direct information and media in a way that the only way to resolve that is to say the state has the same privilege of information as these private corporations do. There is no other way. You don't get that, you know, without a confrontation over, you know, over public versus private spaces and, you know, the public interest versus these things. I don't think you're going to get to it through antitrust, because, you know, you got so many projects in the world that take such scale to do. I mean, that are mountain moving things. Okay, oceans and mountain moving things, especially with the environment that you want to do, that, you know, as Jerry Brown used to say, you're not going to call the granola crowd to do that. You're not.
That's good. Hey, Jerry was on, Sunday morning or something last week. That was great seeing Jerry. He's still fired up.
Well, no, that's what we need. Fired up people, ready to go.
Yeah, you know, you need some more socialism. Yep. You gotta stop being scared of that. I mean, I guess there's such a thing as having too much. I mean, if you try to nationalize the shoeshine shops, I guess you're, you know, I think you've lost your mind. Okay, but but I mean, there's, you know, there needs to be some national control over entities so big they're worth it. You know, they're just they have
Amazon, bunch of,
and I'm not saying, you know, I mean, they become part of the infrastructure that everybody needs, and yeah, they beat out everybody. They became near monopolies, but okay, at that point, you're no longer just a private business.
No,
right. So
I think they're bigger than the military, right?
Well, they might, by this point, they may be. I don't know. Good question.
How would you even quantify their influence? It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I think the one important thing that's happening, and I really see it happening, is that more and more people are considering that we need a new system.
Right.
They don't always call it socialism, but even a lot of people are saying that socialism is what we need, and that's a rising trend in the working class. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And yeah, people who used to be so, you know, after the McCarthy period and stuff like that, even big unions were so afraid that, oh, no, we can't have any Reds because then this and that. That's disappearing now. Big unions like mine don't care about that shit anymore. They just want to see boots on the ground and people out there fighting. And they're not. The least bit anti-communist or anti-socialist or whatever you want to say.
They have to get real about defining what they are. You know, I mean, if capitalism is so great, why are we where we are now? You've got to have a hybrid of all these different systems in order to make it work in a better way.
It's better than feudalism. I mean, you don't see anybody out there picketing for feudalism, do you? Let's bring back King Henry. You don't see that.
You know, it's a confusing narrative when we've called out Trumpism and MAGA and all that as fascist, and now they're turning it on us. Now they're calling us fascists.
Well, of course.
So people will be confused about that because they don't have any idea what it really means. That's right. Yeah, I mean, to hear Trump is just going off the rails. He's just babbling bullshit, you know.
He's on top of the fold.
Man.
I don't think he knows how to do anything else but babble bullshit.
No. And that's, you know, I mean, it's his whole life. Yeah, but how was he rewarded for that? That's the part I can't understand. You know, if you and I go try to bullshit somebody, you know, they just tell us to go take a hike. But with Trump, you know, they elevated him.
He's got backing. Yeah. Otherwise, he'd either be in jail or dead.
Right.
He's got backing.
That's amazing. It really is. Well, we're half hours up here, John.
Yeah, I know. And all we've done is make the mountain bigger. Poor Sisyphus has to climb up again.
I think we learned a lot. I think we learned some ideas today that we didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole, this field of AI has both, you know, big, you know, commercial, technical, and all kinds of implications that you barely, pretty mind-bending. But the immediate and short-term and impacts on labor are going to be felt. I think they're already being felt. I think it's going to make the questions of collective bargaining and of the role of the public as an employer and trainer of last resort for transitions and stuff has got to be front and center.
Well, they're going to have to have guarantees of workforce, you know, included in these contracts, you know, the number of jobs and when jobs change, you know, right. In the Merchant Marine, we used to organize companies and we'd have the whole fleet. And then after the Exxon Valdez, the oil companies, decided they were going to make each ship a separate company so that it would be lessened, the liability would be lessened. So, you know, they're all doing that. They're all making smaller shops. But for the unions, it's guaranteeing jobs, a number of jobs, and being able to supply the new jobs that will be created and try to lessen the impact of layoffs. And, you know, you guys no longer know how to do this job, so you're laid off.
Right. And you know, I hate to say it, but I got to go because the workers.
I know. It's time to get to the picket line.
The auto workers who are dealing with a whole lot of this crap.
I know. That's right, pal. All right. Let's don't waste another minute. All right, everybody. Take care. It's late, but everything comes next. Talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye-bye.